Sorry for the interruption, Rabbi.
No, it's all good. Excellent. All right, folks, tonight's a little different. Usually I come at you with guns blazing and I have really important, I raise my voice and I'm really passionate. Tonight I'll be a little bit more subdued. Not for any particular reason other than I'm exhausted. No, the topic tonight, is that at this moment here on the East Coast, we are now celebrating a Jewish holiday. Yes, it is the holiday known as Tu Bishvat. Tu is the abbreviation Tet and Vav, which looks like a two, right? Tet Vav is the number 15, 9 and 6 is 15. Bishvat means in the month of Shvat. The name of this Hebrew month is called Shvat. And the 15th of this month is a holiday. What is this holiday? If it were really such a serious holiday, do you think I would be Zooming right now? No, I would not be. I am going shopping afterwards and I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to go. So what kind of holiday is this? So this is a holiday that the Mishnah, this goes way back. This is not a Hallmark holiday. This is not something that was recently come across. No, this is a holiday that's already mentioned in the Mishnah more than 2,500 years ago. The Mishnah says that there are four New Years. Jews know how to party. You can't just do one New Year. You got to do it four times. But you have the most classic one, Rosh Hashanah. That's the New Year, what we call the calendar year. And it's the year that we use to, you know, it's like a New Year for life, for human beings. And we're judged certain periods of time at certain periods of time on certain issues. So the 15th of this month of Shvat is what's known as the new year for trees. For trees. I'm not going to get into the technical stuff, but I figured this would be a good opportunity tonight to talk about Judaism and the Torah's perspective on the environment. Because there's really, if I had to summarize and to pick what my mission, my objective of the night is to show you how far ahead the Torah was in its day. It is so far ahead of its time. Let's go through this. One of the most, there's an entire series of legislation, of halacha, Jewish law, regarding the impact on the relationship between man and the environment. One of the most basic sources goes down to where the Torah talks about that if you have to wage a war, and in those days they didn't have guns, they didn't have cannons necessarily, but what they had was a classic battering ram. Now, how did you make a battering ram? You took a good solid chunk of a tree. You had a good solid piece of wood, and you would go ahead, put your fixings on it, and use that as a battering ram to go ahead and to break down the walls. The Torah makes it very clear that even though you're at war and you need these materials, if you have an option between cutting down a fruit-bearing tree versus a non-fruit-bearing tree, it is 100% forbidden for you to cut down a fruit-bearing tree. Now, you say, okay, it's a nice idea, but think about this for a moment. In biblical times, this was tantamount to saying, okay, you can wage your war, but you can only use half of the limited, you know, you have to use half of the resources available to you. You can't use petroleum fuel. No, can't do that. Sorry, you can't wage a war. And you can't use, that was the classic. But the Torah says, no, you still need to be concerned. You cannot cut down a fruit-bearing tree. Why? Because in Hebrew, we call it bal tashchit. Don't destroy. Bal is the same as lo, do not. Tashchit means, shachet means to destroy. Bal tashchit is a prohibition not to destroy without a purpose, an object that serves a benefit. Why? Because the Torah is teaching us that if you have something that's a productive item that benefits not just you, but benefits other future generations, you have no right to destroy. This is not limited, folks, to fruit-bearing trees, although it still applies today. I recall I was very, very young, so I don't know if I have all my details correct. But I remember we were living in New York, and we had a house, and in the backyard, there was a crabapple tree. And it, don't get excited, it really wasn't edible. It made more of a mess than it did anything productive. But I remember a conversation that my parents were having about they wanted to do something and build or extend. I don't remember the details. And the question came up that the only way to do this is to cut down the apple tree. And I remember like, cut down an apple tree. It's not, we don't take apples from it anyway. But the seriousness that my parents were having this conversation made a big impact on me. I don't think I was more than 7, 8 years old. But I remember that conversation and my father saying that he spoke to the rabbi about it. And I'm like, the rabbi? Call the farmer. What are you calling a rabbi for? Yeah, because he was referring, he was talking specifically about this prohibition of not wasting. Now, Maimonides, when he codifies this law, he makes it very clear that it is not limited to that situation of a fruit-bearing tree. Any wasteful destruction of resources that God has given us would fall under this prohibition. That means wasting money, wasting fuel, wasting food. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, do I remember that as a child. How many times my grandmother would say to me or my mother would say, you're going to leave that over? There are children starving in Africa. Remember, this is how familiar.
Name five.
I got a little older, a little more chutzpah, unfortunately. And I said to my mother, I said, Ma, and if I eat the peas, are they not going to starve anymore?
Oh.
I didn't like that answer.
Oh, I wish I'd said that.
Oh, terrible. Right? Terrible. But the Rambam, Maimonides, tells us that any kind of destroying buildings for no reason, tearing your clothing, a lack of concern for an article of clothing. Do you know that King David, at towards the end of his life, couldn't get warm? He was cold no matter how many blankets he had. Why? So the Talmud tells us that because there was a situation where he was running and he came across King Saul. King Saul was the king at the time. David was not yet. And he had an opportunity to actually kill King Saul, who was pursuing David. And he had every right, so to say, in self-defense. But what he did instead is he crept into the cave in which Saul was. And instead of killing him, he took the corner, he cut off the corner of King Saul's garment. As a little reminder, I could have, but I didn't. Now, you like it, you don't like it. The fact is, if you fast forward an additional few decades, when King David is already getting much older, he can't get warm. Says the Talmud, it was a punishment because he showed a lack of respect for an article of clothing. Clothing doesn't have feelings. That's not the point. The point is articles of clothing benefit us, and to treat it with a disgrace and to ruin it, that's not appropriate. In practical terms, this is one of the reasons why we need to do everything we can to conserve energy, our resources, turning off lights, leaky faucets, whatever it is, wasting water, wasting fuel, wasting energy. They have amazing, energy efficient appliances. That's the way to go. Recycling. Yes. These are important ideas. However, It gets much more than that. That I thought was pretty basic. However, if one wanted to study the second chapter in the tractate known as Baba Batra, Baba Batra is a very difficult tractate. But the second chapter, believe it or not, there's an entire series of law that refer, that are dealing with maintaining an in general environmental quality of life. Yeah. Look how far ahead of its times. The Torah talks about prohibitions against air pollution. I'll give you examples in a moment. Noise pollution. water pollution. Yeah, this chapter deals with industries that are prohibited. They must be distanced from residential inhabited areas. For example, in those days, they had what was known as the threshing floor. After you cut down the wheat or the barley, you used to lay it out on a large floor, and then you would attach to an animal a kind of mechanism that would basically, as the animal walked around, it would have spikes at the bottom of that board that the animal would schlep around, and it would break down the chaff. It would break the kernel so that it can begin to separate the kernels, the wheat kernels, from the chaff. Well, what did you do afterwards? You then took it, you took a pitchfork, and you did what's called winnowing. And you would throw it up to the air, allow the wind to separate the chaff from the kernels. The chaff would blow away. It's much lighter, right? Says the Talmud, one second, who wants to have air pollution flying into our city at all times? So number one, there's not allowed to be that threshing floor within a certain distance of a residential area because of the chaff or the dust particles. Not only to people, but it causes vegetation to dry out. Yeah, you have to be concerned about that. You're not allowed to have a cemetery within a certain distance of a residential area. It's not only, you know, cemeteries are usually out in the outskirts of cities. It's not just because land is cheap out there. It's because it's not appropriate to be in a residential area. You know, we don't have these things nowadays, but maybe you have something like it. They used to have a tannery. They used to work on the hides of the animal. In Yiddish, verstinkt. It stank. Why? Because of all of the chemicals, we would call the formaldehyde. It stinks. There's an odor. It was forbidden to have that in a certain distance of the residential area. And if you were to build it, it had to be opposite the way the wind was blowing, because nobody wants that wafting through the city. You're not allowed to burn olive wood on the altar in the temple. Olive wood was used for other things, but you could not burn it on the Mizbeach. Why? Because as wonderful as olives are, olive wood is extremely smoky, and it causes air pollution. In Jerusalem, there were specific laws about zoning restrictions of things that were allowed or not allowed. For example, I'll give you another one. Just want to make sure I'm not skipping a line here. One second. Yeah, I did skip. Hold on. Right? So you have air pollution. You have noise pollution, zoning regulations. I'm not allowed to open up a business in a residential area if the traffic of customers, if I'm open up, let's say I open up a small little mini mart, right? Mm-hmm. So I can't open a 7-Eleven. There you go. No 7-Elevens in a residential neighborhood, right on my street. Why? Because who wants to have that traffic cutting through their yard all the time or in their neighborhood? You want to go to sleep. Yeah. These are laws written in the Talmud itself. Now, I'm pretty sure the 7-Eleven is not expressly referred to in the Talmud, but you get the gist. Okay. There's water pollution. You were not allowed to wash in a public pool with muddy feet, or if this was area that people took drinking water from. I know it sounds basic because that's the world in which we've become, that we are sensitive to this. But I'm talking about a book that, according to the most liberal biblical scholars, is a few thousand years old. Way ahead of its time. In practical terms, we have concern for oil spills, toxic dumping. It's harm to people. It's harm to animals. It's harm to vegetation. Concern for even improving the quality of life. It's not just you can't do harm. You have to do things that will improve the quality of life. How many of you have ever wondered why every state has a Department of Parks and Recreation? If I were the governor of a state, I would abolish the whole thing. Yeah, fine. One. If you want people are going to go out to Arizona to see the Grand Canyon, why do I need some little regional little park in my area? You know why? Because it's a biblical mitzvah. Did you know that? It's a biblical mitzvah. The Torah talks, if this is not even like a midrash somewhere, I'm talking black on white verses. It says it explicitly that the cities in Israel need to be surrounded by, in Hebrew, what's called a migrash, an area left for public enjoyment, a parkland. You know that? There needs to be grassy area. Why? Why is that so important?
Yeah, but I didn't know it was in the Torah.
Who wants to take a guess here? Venture a guess. Why is that so important? You cannot build on it, not residential, not industrial, not farmland. It needs to be an area like we call a park where people can come and enjoy. Why is that so critical?
Well, I'd say that it probably has to do with meditation, and so you can go out and make that connection with nature, because just to remember basically where you came from.
Good, good. Just out of curiosity, assuming COVID ended right here, right now, and you're all going to go on a trip, please tell me, where are you going? I don't need to know a specific place, but the type of place you're going to go.
Beach. A lot of people would
What's
go outside.
Ocean area.
Water. What else?
Mountains.
Mountains.
Where else are you going to go? I guarantee you three things. It will have the following three pieces to it. Air, space, and beauty. That's what it'll have. Air, space, and beauty. Everything we don't have in quarantine. It is within human nature to want to have air, space, and beauty. We want it and we need it. You have to be able to clear your head. Whether you're into meditation or you're into nature is irrelevant. You need a chance to breathe, get out there. And therefore, the Torah says you have to do things and create areas that will improve your quality of life. Cities in Israel must have it. And I think that's the basis why so many wonderful states and cities around the country, around the world, understand that concept. And you build parkland specifically.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I was going to say, it's been written about that being outdoors, being out in nature is beneficial to your health.
That's correct.
That it improves many, many things, your mental health, your physical health.
Exactly.
Just being outside.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's what the Torah is teaching. Yeah. You need to have a place. If all you have in your neighborhood is, you know, like I did back in the days in Brooklyn, right? There is a blade of grass that's, you know, it's become famous now. The blade of grass in Brooklyn. It's what's it called? The concrete jungle.
The tree that grows.
You got to get out. That's why so many people, they go up to the Poconos or they go up to the Adirondacks or they go up to the, you know, all the different, because you got to have it. You need it. We all need that. There were special enactments because of the beauty of Jerusalem itself. It's the capital of beauty. Number one, you were not allowed to have pottery kilns in Jerusalem because they create too much smoke. The city of Jerusalem can't have it. In Talmudic times, it's a requirement that there need to have been daily garbage pickup. You're not allowed to let garbage build up. Now, you say to me, don't look that way today. I got the same question. But that is really the way it's supposed to be. How about the concept of the sabbatical year, the Shemitah, the seven-year cycle? It's again the same concept. I don't want to suck up all of the nutrients that the earth has to offer. It's a resource. Crop rotation, the Maimonides writes, is part of the wisdom behind the sabbatical year. Because we do. A chance to replenish all of the nutrients. Soil preservation. You know, when entering in the land of Israel, They were told, the Jewish people were told, Joshua was told to conquer it in the most beneficial way, slowly and gradually. Don't conquer the whole country at once. Why? Because then there are going to be parts that are going to remain desolate, and then things are going to become overgrown, and wildlife will take over cities, because you can't possibly settle the entire country over in a short period of time. So do it smartly, slowly, so that it's beneficial for humans, animals, and vegetation. Okay. I can go on and on and on, because there's also a whole story, a whole section of legislation related to our care for creatures of this world, animals. I've said this before, that if you're going to sit down to eat your dinner and you own a pet, please make sure that you feed your pet before you partake of your meal. That is a Jewish law, not a suggestion. This is a law. You are not. And anybody know where the source for this is? You should. And don't say the Torah. I know. We're in the Torah. I knew one of you was going to say that.
It's when they watered the camels before they watered themselves.
Not a great example. And no. I'll show you why in a minute. Give me another one.
Fed the animals first.
I'll give you a hint. It's in the Shema prayer.
Yeah.
Ah, now everybody's like, ooh, I should know this.
The second paragraph.
Yes, in the second paragraph. But that's not fair, Randy. That's the largest one. The odds were good. Come on, Randy. Give me more. Come on. You're onto it. And if you will listen to and hearken to my mitzvah, to all my commandments, I'll provide the rain in the season. Da 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 da. Right? You're familiar with all
right.
this? Remember?
Yeah.
So that, what? Come on, you know the verse. Safta digonecha v'sirochcha v'yitzarecha v'nasati, and I will give esev besadcha livemtecha, grass to grow for your animals to eat. Then it says v'achalta v'savata, and you will eat and be satisfied. Please note the order. The animals are provided food before we are. That is a law. Yes, that's right. You have a pet. Please make sure that your pet, not only built Bob Barker to make sure that it's neutered, but also to make sure that it is fed. Sorry, that it is fed before you are. However, Michelle, the verse you quoted, unfortunately, you quoted backwards. When it comes to drink, when they got there, Moshe says, you and your animals. In fact, in the Jewish law, it brings down, according to many opinions, that when it comes to drinking, human beings go first because it's more life-threatening. If you need a drink and your animal needs a drink, you get first. But food, you can live for 5 more minutes without food. Give your animal first.
So Rachel offered the water first before Rivka.
You mean Rivka. Rivka offered the water to Eliezer first and then offered to give the animals. That is correct. That is correct. So that's
like the movie had it wrong.
Oh,
what a shocker.
Such a shock. Okay, so what do we have here? So the concern for animals, again, number one, you must feed them first before feeding yourself. You buy a brand new pair. Let's say, God willing, we're making a wedding, bought a new suit. So the first time I wear my suit, there's a special bracha that I'm going to make. The bracha of Shehechianu. Yes, we don't just say Shehechianu on a holiday or a festival. We make the Shehechianu on real, significant goodness in our life. For example, when you get a decent pair of clothing. No, not if you get an undershirt. Undershirts don't qualify. It has to be something of significance. a suit, a nice dress, perhaps. But the question was asked, what if I get a nice pair of leather shoes? Should I make a shechianu or not? It's a good question. Yeah. Some leather shoes are more expensive than the suits we buy. But the answer
that's is killing probably no. That's killing animals.
That's correct. The answer is no. Why? Because although you're getting enjoyment, an animal did give up its life for it. And therefore, you can't be over the top joyous. And you hold back from making the bracha. Look how sensitive we are. Listen, I'm sure, I'm going to sit down after this and I'm going to enjoy my non-dairy dinner. And I'm going to enjoy it. Sorry, Sharon. And I'm going to really enjoy it. I like animal food. Not what they eat, but I eat them, right? But that doesn't mean that I don't have a sensitivity. So here it is. I want a pair of shoes. I'm entitled to wear a pair of leather shoes. If there was something intrinsically wrong with it, the Torah would forbid it. But the Torah says you are allowed to wear leather shoes. You can wear a leather garment. That's fine. Just don't gloat. Don't make a special bracha that talks about how much you enjoy it. Enjoy it. Okay. Don't make a bracha on it. That shows a certain sensitivity.
But you can't wear them on Yom Kippur.
That's also true, but it has nothing to do with this. That's true. Okay? But if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Because if I just put you on the spot and say, okay, can you name for me a few anti-mixing laws in the Torah? Things you're not allowed to mix. Go ahead. Go.
Dairy and meat and dairy.
Good. Milk and meat. That's a no-no. What else?
Linen and wool.
Linen and wool. You're not allowed to wear a garment that has those two fibers woven together. What else?
You're not supposed to mix breeds of animals.
Correct. You're not allowed to crossbreed animals.
Wheat and grapes. Kilian. Okay.
To go ahead and plant.
Plant.
Great. Plant. A cross pollinization like that underground. Yes, you should not be doing a wheat and grapevine together or others.
Uh-huh. I guess I don't understand that one.
What?
Men and women in prayer.
Well, I don't know about that.
Okay.
Men and women, yes, in prayer specifically, yes, but no, I don't think I would call that an anti-mixing law. Between you and me, the Torah is very pro mixing men and women. In the right circumstances. Very pro. Okay. Just at the right time, at the right place, you know? But come on, there's at least one or two
others. Hold on. The wheat and grape thing. I don't understand that one.
It's called kilayim. You're mixing two kinds of species. You're not allowed, if the roots of them are going to intermingle, that's a no-no. There's an entire section of agricultural law related to the non-mixing of species like that. It's called kilayim.
What about hybrid vegetables that they're making now?
Now we're getting somewhere. Can I go ahead and graft one fruit tree with another? For example, your delicious, absolutely scrumptious tangerine. There is no natural thing called a tangerine. It's a hybrid. Am I correct? You're looking at me like I'm funny.
They make cauliflower and broccoli together. It's whatever it's called.
Broccoflower.
Broccoflower, right.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe tangerine.
The tangelo is certainly
tangelo.
A...
Yes.
Oh, now here we go. Thank you. Tangelo. Thank you. Right. So you're not allowed to go ahead and graft those trees together to create another one. There's an entire slew of anti-mixing laws in the Torah. And I'm sure none of you stayed up late last night thinking about this, but that's okay. You can do it tonight. Why?
I fed my dog what first.
What is the Torah so particular about anti? So, listen, everything I mentioned to you are all things that are 100% fine to partake of. There's nothing unkosher about grapes. There's nothing unkosher about wheat. Nothing unkosher about wool. Nothing unkosher about linen. Nothing unkosher about dairy. Nothing unkosher about meat. It's purity. Just fixing them is a problem. Why?
Keeping purity.
Okay. So beautiful. The idea is that God clearly created each species for a reason. For me to go ahead and to lose the identity of each one by grafting it, mixing it, shows a lack of sensitivity to the resource that God himself made. Don't do that. Meat has its function. Dairy has its function. To mix the two together means you show a lack of sensitivity. If you go ahead, think about it. You have two students in your class, one who has this strength and one who has that strength. And you just lump them together and treat them the same way. You're doing a disservice to both of them. Recognize the value of each one by itself. In fact, if you remember, I'm not even going to hold you to this, even though it's really the first chapter in the Torah. In all of the creations, it talks about the fact that everything is created limina, each according to its kind. You remember that? It comes up throughout. As a kid, I'm like, what do you mean each according to its kind? It's like in English, it's like, what does that mean? He created all of the species, each according to its kind. Duh, that's each species. What do you mean each? The answer that many of the commentators tell us is that it's this point. Each species was created, each for its own kind, because each one has its value. Each one has its uniqueness. When I go ahead and I mix this one and that one and I start to... I'm losing, I'm desensitizing the beauty of each one of them. Okay.
Oh, like a labradoodle?
Wasn't on the top of my list, but that's a good one. Okay. There are many, many more when it comes to legislation regarding this area. But let's see if we can try to understand why. Let's try to get a better understanding. So I think, Monroe, you mentioned it earlier, and that is, it gives a person an opportunity to contemplate nature, to contemplate all of God's works. Here's the important point, though. Who does the world, who does the earth belong to?
God.
God. God is the owner. You know what we are? We're managers. That's what we are. We do not own this earth. The same way we really we don't really own our own bodies. It's on loan to us. Our job is to be the best custodial, right? The best custodian I can be when it comes to that. We are the managers. We're already told this from the beginning. When God put Adam and Eve in the garden, it says, Vayanicheu began Eden, that he placed them in the Garden of Eden, la'avda u'lishamra. Literally means to work it and to watch over it. That's right. It's to work it, gain from it, go ahead, enjoy it. But make sure you're guarding it carefully. Make sure you're managing the resources properly. To just have wanton destruction and to just ignore and say, whatever, wrong. That's not a good manager. Manager has to make sure that it's taken care of. Improper use of the world is like stealing from God. That's what it is. He gave you resources and you're just blowing it. That's not how it works. There's a beautiful midrash that says that when God put man onto this earth, right? He gave him the right to use it. Let me just find the quote. Here it is. At the time that the Holy One, blessed be he, created the first man, he took him and had him pass before all the trees in the Garden of Eden and said to him, see my works, how fine and excellent they are. Now all that I created was created for you, man. Think about this. Do not ruin or desolate the world. For if you harm it, there will be none to fix it. You have an obligation to use the world, not abuse it. We are entitled to use the resources that are here. But perhaps Someone asked me this question years ago. How come we don't take a greater stand on this issue today? How come you don't find the Jews fighting this battle about the environment and the resources? And there are, but it's not necessarily the top issue. And here's what I think is the truth. The current environmentalist, that the movement, they look at the way the Torah describes our relationship with the world, is that if you look in the beginning, that first chapter, it talks about God being, man being the last creation, and God turning to man and telling him, "Umilu et haaretz, fill the earth, v'chiv shuha." That's the Hebrew word. V'chiv shuha means and subdue it. You are to conquer the world. It is man's job. The environmentalist, and I hope I'm not offending anyone, the environmentalist looks at that and says, that's wrong. Man has no right to conquer the earth. The earth is holy. The earth is a God resource. You have no right to subdue it in any way, shape, or form. Now, I don't agree with that. I spent the first 40 minutes of our class showing you of where the Torah has tremendous sensitivity to the environment, has tremendous sensitivity to ecology and taking care. The difference in the perspective is what is man's role vis-a-vis the nature, vis-a-vis the environment and the world. We believe, the Torah teaches, that the central figure in the world and everything was created for man. And I don't mean as opposed to woman, I mean mankind, humankind. We are at the center of it all. Everything else in the world is meant to be a mechanism, a tool to help us. We are at the top of the pecking order. If you want to think about it, if you go to a Broadway play, the main actor or the main actress is not the first one on stage. All of the props have to be in place. All of the lighting, everything to support the actor or the actress to do it. Mankind is the actor. The props, that's the rest of the world. God has appointed mankind. Unfortunately, this is where we differ. The pure environmentalist sees man as no more significant than a tree, no more significant than an animal or any other species. They're on equal footing. And the same way that I have to protect myself and I have no right to do harm or anything for that matter against a fellow human being, I have no right to do anything against a fellow tree or a fellow tiger or a fellow whatever. This is perhaps where we differ. Almost all human activity, any advancement in their minds is seen as intrusive and destructive. Nothing done without ensuring absolutely no negative impact on the environment. And while I'm sensitive to it, here's where we differ. The Torah views nature as a machine, as a mechanism, a tool. Humanity has the right to operate and steer it in whatever direction benefits mankind. The car doesn't have a vote whether it should go to Giant or whether it should go to Safeway. The car doesn't get a vote. Man gets the vote. The car, maybe the car prefers Safeway because there's more open parking spots and the spots are a little bit wider than it is at Giant, which drives me crazy. The car prefers, it likes its paint job. But at the end of the day, the car doesn't get that vote. It's our right to control the car. Obviously, if you're smart, you don't abuse the car. You don't run it ragged. You maintain it. You change the tires, change the oil, and you treat it well. It'll give you 300, 400,000 miles. But not because the car is the most important thing. The car is a means by which I can accomplish something. That's the difference. Nature is not a person in that regard. We treat it with respect. You don't cut down trees without permission. And as I started with, you don't, if you have an option of a fruit bearing or a non-fruit bearing, then the non-fruit bearing tree, because look how much more productivity a fruit bearing tree can offer mankind. Unfortunately, this is where we differ. We believe in a combination. It's like a person that I treat it with that respect, and I don't have the ability to just do whatever I want with it, but it's also a machine. It's a tool. According to the Torah, a fruit tree, you generally don't cut down. But at the end of the day, if the wood's value is greater than the fruit, like the crabapple tree in my Brooklyn backyard, where the wood was significantly more valuable, what is the halacha then? What's the law? Can I cut down the tree? The answer is yes. Because it's all based on what's going to be more valuable to serve mankind. It's
and
not
who determines that?
I'm sorry?
Who would determine that?
Mankind. How much would it, how much can I get? If I chop down this tree, I can get approximately 10 bundles, 50 bundles of wood that go for $1.50 a thing. And how much, you know, for the crab apples, I can get diddly. I couldn't get anything for it. So the value of the wood perhaps it outweighs the value of the apple. So I'm just, whether that's the final answer or not is irrelevant. The point is I'm trying to bring out is that while it's 100% true that we have the sensitivity towards the environment and we have the right, we have to be sensitive, not to waste it, not to be frivolous, to take into account all kinds of agriculture, animals, species. We take that all into account. But at the end of the day, we don't equate mankind with any of the others. Treat it with, we use it, but not abuse it. And that, I think, is the most important idea. Where it says that we are to subdue it, it's not to conquer it by stripping the land of its resources. That's not conquering it. Rather, in conjunction with the attitude of to work it and to guard it, that's what it means to be a manager. Conquer it and be a good manager. A responsible use that's mixed with a sincere concern. Growth in technology mixed with conservation and preservation. God, definitely, it's a God-centered ecology movement where man plays the most critical role in all of it. Not that the earth in and of itself is the central figure. It's mankind that is. This is perhaps the differing point. So when we sit tonight, tomorrow, and we're going to enjoy some of our fruits and vegetables to, in honor of Tu B'Shvat, this is what I think you should at least become aware of, to at least be sensitive. The Torah has what to say even about a topic as, you know, environmentalism. Yes, but it's a combination. Sincere concern to take care of it, but mankind has the does play the central role in all of it. I see that there are some perplexed and perhaps quite inquisitive looks. Feel free to ask. Go ahead, Arlene.
Okay, so when we went to Israel, they said that the Israel state bird is the crane.
Yes.
Because of all the development.
Correct.
I'm just curious if the how does that relate to being stewards of the earth if everything's being built up and it's using the land for development as opposed for growth of natural things?
The answer is I can't answer definitively because it has to be weighed. You have the right to go ahead and continue to build, but you have to make sure that you're not going to the point of where you're ruining the resources. For example, right? I don't know if it's a law there or not, but as a general rule, right? I think here in Maryland, we had it that if you go ahead and you disturb a certain number of acres of farmland, of agricultural land, you have the right to get it somewhere else. Purchase, let's say, for example, when Shoresh was developing the campus, so there was a certain number of acres that we were disturbing trees or whatever. We worked it out with the county that we went ahead and purchased in another place land that would go ahead and have those trees on it. So yes, I'm developing the land to serve a function called camp so that we can do things to help educate, et cetera, but not at the expense of saying, I don't care. Okay, so I ripped up trees. That's not how it works. It's a balancing act. So I can't answer specifically about Israel, but I can guarantee you that they sit down in a city planning, in a zoning, and that kind of, and they weigh what is going to be the environmental impact, not just on the residents in the neighborhood and on the water supply. How does this play out on a larger scale? It's a balance. I don't know the correct answer because obviously each place and time is different. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Does that also include like housing developments that take, you know, where deer used to live and now they're out, you know, in public or not in public, but.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes, but I don't know if just because we're building means we did the wrong thing. I don't know if I agree with that. Yes, at the end of the day, Randy, can I go ahead and develop this area if I know that it just means the deer are going to migrate to another place where they'll be just fine? If I go ahead and I strip everything in a 250 mile radius and there's nowhere to go except I-70 and they're going to get splattered, yeah, then I need to take that much greater into consideration. But it's, again, it's a balancing act. Is this what I'm doing going to be beneficial for mankind without abusing the situation and the environment? There's no hard and fast rule because everything has to be weighed. I can't give you it's not like you ask me, well, how many times do I need to wash my hands when I get up in the morning? I can answer that. That's a definitive rule. It's not depending on the environment, depending on what mood I'm in, depending on how many other deer live in the neighborhood. It's a hard and fast rule. This is a weighted issue. That's it? Come on.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We talked a little bit about grafting different fruits or vegetables and coming up with something new or these new bioengineered foods. Are those considered okay to eat if you're breaking a rule to make them?
Great question. The Talmud deals with that question, and the Talmud says something very interesting, and it bases it on the reading of the verse itself. It's not just a thought. The Talmud differentiates between the act of grafting, the act of crossbreeding, and benefiting from someone else's doing it. The Talmud differentiates. And its conclusion is, while you are prohibited from doing it, you are not prohibited from partaking of it. So if you enjoy tangelos, you are welcome to eat them. Just don't be the farmer who's actually grafting them.
Or funding the farmer for making them, don't own the company.
Right. The Talmud draws that distinction and bases it on the verse.
And I think about how science is using and cross breeding and stuff to come up with things to use in medicines and stuff like that. Are we using God's creations that he made in its kind and then doing our own creating and making our own kind?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Well, you said that God made everything in its kind and you're not supposed to mix things.
Well, what about specific things? I can go ahead and mix my Splenda and my coffee with hot water and have one of God's greatest gifts called a hot cup of coffee in the morning. I can
species.
Mix that all I want. And in fact, I do it multiple times a day. I know. I'm the anti-max mixer. Mm-hmm. No, but you can go. It's not just a hard rule. You can never mix anything. if you're going to mix things to a point of where they lose their identity, you're referring to medical science. They're not mixing species. They may be mixing a chemical and a drug and an extract. That's totally different. That's not a problem. I'm talking about creating, mixing real species. For example, you're not allowed to crossbreed a horse and a donkey, right? That's a classic example, right? What do you get when you do crossbreed them?
A mule.
Fascinating tidbit of information. What's a characteristic of a mule besides being stubborn? I know.
Sterile.
It's sterile. It can't produce. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's what the Torah is talking about. To go ahead and to mix, you know, medicine A with medicine B so that you have a compound, that's not a problem.
But what about like the vaccines that are made of RNA? That's genetic material that they are probably mixing. I mean,
no problem. No problem. What's the problem? What species is RNA?
All species have all animal species have RNA.
That's fine. Can I go ahead and enjoy a piece of an animal? Sharon, don't listen. Can I go ahead and enjoy a piece of animal?
Sure.
Absolutely. Sharon, so why can't Sharon, I enjoy? So why can't I enjoy some of its RNA? I just, again, the point is that we have to be sensitive to both sides of the equation. But again, and I hope, again, I hope I'm not offending anybody. Here's where I can't be on the same page as a pure environmentalist, because in their minds, the environment is the central figure. And that's not my perspective. The Torah says mankind is it. Can you do animal experimentation? Can it be done? Can you test a potential vaccine on a lab rat? Is that okay? Yes. According to the Torah?
Yes.
Why?
Yes.
Why? It's a species. What, right? Why don't you test it on your neighbor?
Because it's to help. It's to help humans.
Oh, what do you mean? Now all of a sudden you're okay with that, huh? I'm joking.
For the benefit of humans.
The answer is that's correct. It's because if the ultimate goal, you're not just sticking the lab rat with something that just popped into your head. You did research. In theory, this should work. Let's see. But instead of doing it on a human being, you're doing it on one of God's creations that's there to serve mankind. So instead of my eating a cow, I'm going to inject the cow and see if it works. It intrinsically, it's the same thing. I'm using it as a mechanism, as a means by which to enhance mankind. That's fine. Does that give you the right to go ahead and abuse, you know, again, I remember as a kid, terrible things. I don't know why. We should really start when we're older, when we have the wisdom, and then get younger so that we can enjoy it.
Right? They tried that in the last, they tried that in the last season of Mork and Mindy. It failed.
Oh, whatever. It just doesn't, right? I remember as a kid, we used to have two things, right? I remember one of my friends, we were walking down the street and there was a stray dog, whatever it is, and he kicked it. And I was like, why'd you do that? It was fun. Okay. I didn't see the fun in that, right? But meanwhile, coming from the same righteous guy, right? What did I do as a kid? We would catch a daddy long leg and I would see how can the daddy long leg survive without that leg. And then I would try that leg and that leg, you know? Terrible. That's not, yeah, I know. That's it. You're old. You're not coming back next week. I got it. Fine. Right? But that's
what
about
wearing
you have to be. You can't, you have the right to use it legitimately with a sincere focus to just indiscriminately start beating up animals or anything and cutting down trees. And I'll tell you one other thing. I shouldn't, but I'll do it anyway. Right? I'm not a big fan of what they now is such a hot thing called these rage rooms. You know what rage room is? Where you can go rent a place for an hour, half hour, whatever it is, and they set up broken, you know, they set up computers or glass, whatever it is, and you put on your shield, whatever, and you
smash it.
And you smash and you get out all your aggression. They're making a boatload of money because we are so out of control. It's terrible. But I think intrinsically, I have a problem with it. because you're not just, listen, we're all human beings and sometimes we get upset and we do things like that. But to go ahead and call up and say, hi, I'd like to schedule a time for me to let loose, rip this stupid computer to pieces because I'm so frustrated. That's not the answer. It's destructive. I mean, you're building up the characteristic of, I'm going to destroy this computer. No, that's not what it's about. I would rather you spend two or three sessions with an anger management counselor. It's money much better spent than Rage Room. But that's what I'm talking about. That sensitivity, at least, that the world in which we live is there for us to enjoy. It's there for us to use. But be sensitive. Don't waste it. Don't abuse it. And have that sense that you are put here to be the manager. You are in charge. Take good care of it. That's my Tu B'Shvat thought. Any other questions?
How about wearing alligator boots?
If that floats your boat.
Or leather made out of boots. Or being wearing unclean shoes. Things that are made out of unclean pigs or alligators.
Go for it. If that's what you like, there's no problem.
Monroe, is the question, can you wear something from a non-kosher animal?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, yeah, that's the right, question? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The only prohibition about non-kosher is not to eat it, not to ingest it. Yeah, that's a good question.
Can you use a mule to work?
You can use a mule. Yep. Do you have one in Frederick?
You just can't put the mule and the donkey together.
There's no date night for the horse and the donkey this week. Nope.
They can work together. You said they can't work together. Well,
they can't work together.
They can't. But they're different paces.
No, they can't.
Nope, you can't do that either. You cannot put in the same yoke two different animals. A horse, a cow and a, what is it? A cow?
Ox.
An ox and a donkey, right? That's the classic example in the Torah, the ox and the donkey. You're not supposed to harness them together because they have different eating schedules, different paces, and it's uncomfortable and unfair to the animals. That's another good example of sensitivity. As a farmer, I don't care. Just get the job done. Wrong. If you're a manager, you got to know your resources and use them right.
Right.
Just like you can't muzzle.
Can't muzzle. Not fair to the animal. That's why I nosh all day. All right. Ladies, gentlemen, have a great week. Rest of it. Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you.
All right.
Have a good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Bye, everybody. Bye.